Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. My guest today is Gretchen Soren. Dr. Soren is a distinguished service professor and director of the Cooperstown Graduate Program at the State University of New York and a noted curator of museum exhibits. She has a new book out titled Driving While Black, African-American Travel and the Road to Civil Rights. The book is a basis for a forthcoming documentary by Rick Burns, which will air on PBS later this year. Professor Soren, welcome to the program, and congratulations on both the book and the documentary.
Oh, thank you so much.
So let me just start with a real basic question here. How did you get the idea to write this book?
Well, actually, I was working on an exhibition in Saratoga Springs, New York, and a colleague of mine asked me if I had ever heard of the Negro Motorist Green Book. This is probably about 25 years ago, and I had never heard of it, but I was intrigued. And so I started doing some research and asked a graduate student of mine who lived in Chicago when he went home. I knew that there was a green book at the Chicago Public Library. I found that in their catalog. And he made a copy of the Negro Motorist Green Book for me from the 1940s. And that was really how I got started. And the more I looked at the book and thought about, well, you know, it's really just like a phone book. For African Americans, of places to stay, that I started thinking, well, you know, this is really not about the Green Book. It's really about the automobile. Mm. And that's how I got started.
I want to come back to that Green Book a little bit later, but I had another sort of general question I wanted to put out there at the beginning. So one of the principal themes of your book, as the title suggests, is how the automobile was intertwined with the broader civil rights struggles of African Americans in the 20th century and a lot of focus on the post-war period. And you argue that the automobile transformed Black life in ways that were, and I'm quoting your book here, far-reaching and totally unexpected. So I just wondered if you could tell me briefly about the far-reaching and the unexpected nature of those transformations.
Well, I think African American travel was pretty humiliating. If you traveled in many parts of the country, travel was segregated, and you had to sit in the back of the bus, you had to sit in the Negro car on the train. So it was pretty horrible for Black people to travel. Even in the North, you might be relegated to the Negro car, so that if the train was going south, so that they didn't have to ask you to get up and move. So for when you had your own automobile and you could travel where you wanted, go where you wanted, when you wanted, and not be constrained by the Negro car or the back of the bus, that was pretty far reaching for African Americans. It really gave you back your dignity. Mm. And unexpected, I think. The whole idea of etiquette, when we think of driving, we think about, you know, the rules of the road. You defer to a driver on your right. You, you know, there are certain rules of driving. Well, if you were in a wagon and two wagons approached each other, the person who was white always expected deference. Mm. They expected that the Black wagon driver would allow the white one to go first. There was always deference expected, that you would tip your hat, that you would be deferential. With the automobile, because of the speed of the automobile and the danger of driving, there could be no deference. You couldn't expect someone to know that there was somebody Black behind the wheel, and therefore they should defer to you when you were driving. So traffic laws, when they were developed, didn't take that into consideration at all. They basically said there can be no deference because of safety. So safety concerns came first, not racial bias.
Yeah, that's interesting. So in traveling by car, though, and you mentioned the deference with the wagons, in the era of the wagons, you do describe, though, how Black drivers had to take precautions to protect themselves from the dangers coming from white racism when they were traveling by car, even though it took them out of the Negro car on the train. It introduced new concern. So remind some of us, remind us about some of those precautions.
Well, one of the things that was that the automobile brought, it wasn't perfect. You were now traveling through territory that you previously had been excluded from. Mm. So African Americans started traveling through spaces that white people considered to be all white spaces. They were not supposed to be in those spaces, through communities that were considered all white communities, through sundown towns, all white towns. And so there you could encounter an angry mob. You could encounter, if you could be seen and people knew that you were African-American, you might be stopped by the police. You might be taken into custody. There were definitely dangers to driving. That's one of the reasons that African-Americans tended to stick to the highways. And after the interstate highway system was built, that made it a little safer for African-American drivers because they would not go through little towns. They would always stay on the highways. If you were driving, say, from New York south toward Florida, you would stay on I-95. You would stick to the main roads and not get off the highway because it was safer to stay on the highway. And if you were going at highway speeds, faster speeds, it might be more difficult as well to tell who was driving, whether the person was black or was white. There were even some instances where African-American men who were driving nice cars would keep a chauffeur's cap on the seat next to them. So just in case they were stopped, they could argue that they were the chauffeur. And they were not driving the car because there were many whites who didn't believe that African Americans should own nice cars.
I'm Grant Reher. You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, and I'm speaking with Gretchen Soren, author of the new book, Driving While Black, African American Travel and the Road to Civil Rights. So in your book, and you were talking about the precautions people were taking, one of the things that was sort of interesting, and you tell some funny stories about it too, of the, you know, kind of loading up the car and being able to drive straight through without stopping, you know, the food, coffee can to, what did you, I think in the book you called it the pea can.
The pea can, yes.
We had one of those too when I was a kid, I remember. But you mentioned the Green Book as the thing that got you started down this path. And in the years since you first discovered that, I think it's come more into the public consciousness, the existence of that book, maybe not so much the details. But you spend some time on that in your book. So tell us about this famous Green Book. How important was it in this struggle and in the precautions that the African American citizens were taking when they were driving in their cars?
I think it was important. Perhaps it's not as important as it has become today because we're not as familiar with the plethora of other guidebooks that existed. There were dozens and dozens of African-American travel guides. And the Green Book was really just one of many. There was one called Travel Guide, Grayson's Guide, The Travel Book. I mean, there were so many different travel guides. And African-Americans also got information about places that they could travel to safely as a result of his bad experience. He decided he was going to do something about it. He was going to write a travel guide. So he and his wife, Alma, begin writing this travel guide out of their Lenox Avenue storefront in Harlem. And he's a very savvy guy, and he approaches Standard Oil. And I think the reason that everyone knows about the Negro Motorist Green Book is because when he approached Standard Oil, he got them to write a contract with him so that they gave out the Green Book at their Esso gas stations, Esso, which is now today Exxon, and they also sold it. So his travel guide had more visibility and was more widely distributed than many of the others.
Mm. And you argue in your book that the automobile became a tool in the battle to end discrimination in public accommodations, that it had an effect on that. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Well, when African Americans, I think there are many facets to this. When African Americans went out on the road, they were taking their travel dollars with them. And so they had the money, they had disposable income that they could use to buy hotel rooms, to buy restaurant meals, to buy souvenirs. And gradually, as we got into the 1950s and 1960s, people that sold things like hotel rooms and restaurant meals and souvenirs wanted to get some of that money. So that was one issue. But generally, the automobile placed African-Americans in front of white Americans. And there were many white Americans that said, oh, you know, maybe, you know, these folks aren't. So then maybe the stereotypes are not what we think they are. But very importantly, the automobile became a tool in the civil rights movement. And I don't think the civil rights movement could have happened the way it did without the automobile. Mm. And it really did facilitate everything that took place during the civil rights movement. For example, during the Montgomery bus boycott, the folks purchased a fleet of automobiles and used those automobiles to drive people to work. People had to continue to go to work and if they wanted to keep their jobs. And they couldn't. Everybody couldn't walk to work, and so this fleet of automobiles was used to carry people to work, as private cars were used to take people to work, and black cabs were used to take people to work. But the other thing that was very important outside of boycotts were that automobiles. If you flew into a southern city to participate in a march or a boycott. Or some sort of civil disobedience, you would be at the airport and you would be stuck because black cabs were not permitted to pick up people at the airport. And so you wouldn't be able to get from the airport to downtown. You wouldn't be able to get from the airport to your hotel, your black hotel. So African-American leaders and people who were flying into various communities for these civil rights marches rented cars. And a rental car becomes absolutely essential to the movement.
Hmm. You know, putting all that together, and when I was reading through your book, you know, I was sort of left with this one conclusion: is that travel, then, in and of itself, was an act of civil rights activism, and it kind of needs to be seen that way.
That's exactly the way I see it.
Yeah.
I think about the vast number of middle-class African-Americans who it was really dangerous. It could be really dangerous to travel, but this huge number of middle-class black Americans who went out on the road and took their lives in their hands and pushed the cause of civil rights in this very quiet way. It was kind of a quiet form of protest.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Gretchen Soren, the director of the Cooperstown Graduate Program at the State University of New York, and the author of Driving While Black, African-American Travel and the Road to Civil Rights. I wanted to ask you a question about actually purchasing the cars, because you talk a lot about that in your book, the decision of what type of car was the best kind of car for African-Americans, thinking about some of the precautions that they needed to take and so on. And we know that discriminatory real estate and bank loan and government policies kept many African-Americans from being able to purchase homes, particularly during the post-war period. I'm wondering whether there were similar hurdles for car purchases, maybe in terms of loans or getting insurance or other kinds of things that African Americans had to contend with.
I was really interested in this whole idea about car brand and identity, because I knew that American Jews wouldn't buy Fords because Ford was a raging anti-Semite. And I wondered about what kinds of cars African Americans purchased because they had some very specific needs when they were traveling. and they had the need to carry a ton of stuff with them. They had, because you didn't know where you could stop, you might carry extra cans of gas. You carried a can to pee in. You carried a large cooler full of food. You might carry extra fan belts and water for the radiator. You might carry blankets and pillows so you could sleep in the car if you couldn't find a hotel that would accept you. So there were, you had a lot of gear that you needed to carry. And that meant you needed a big car. African Americans were also frightened that they might, if you ran into an angry mob, they might turn over your car. But if you had a big, heavy car, that would be more difficult. Mm. So I started looking at marketing studies. There were a series of marketing studies that were done in the 1940s and 1950s by the African American newspapers with black marketing firms. And they basically identified the cars. They did surveys and they identified the cars that black people bought. And black African Americans tended to buy large, heavy cars. And the preferred car was the Buick. Now, a Buick was probably, it wasn't the absolute top of the line. It was the next tier down. It was a reliable car. And that was the other thing that the black drivers wanted, was a car that was reliable, something that wasn't going to strand you on the highway. So you wanted a reliable car, a heavy car, a car with a big trunk. Mm. And Buick fit that bill.
Hmm. And so you tell a lot of individual stories about families and travel in this book. Is there one story or that you encountered, discovered in your research that has stuck with you more than any others?
I guess the stories that really stuck with me were the stories about automobile accidents.
Mm.
It didn't dawn on me until I started doing this research how dangerous it could be when you went out on the road. There were only, hospitals were segregated. There were only in the 1950s about 200 black hospitals around the country. And those hospitals were not all accredited. They weren't all the most modern, up-to-date hospitals, and they weren't certainly all trauma hospitals. And so if you went out on the road and you got into a car accident, like the famous jazz singer Bessie Smith did in 1923, her arm was almost severed in an automobile accident, and she died. She bled to death because there was just no hospital to accept her. And I think those were the stories that were so incredibly shocking to me. There were HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities, that would not allow their athletes to travel because they were afraid if there was an automobile accident or a bus accident that their athletes wouldn't get any care.
Wow. If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, and my guest is Professor Gretchen Soren. So you cover this toward the end of the book. The phrase driving while black is a relatively recent one as sort of common parlance, and it has a particular meaning today. And you were obviously drawing on that and choosing it for the title of your book. I mean, there's meant to be a historical link there, and you talk a little bit about that. What do you think your research suggests about the current problems that African American drivers encounter with the police? Is there a way that we should be thinking about that perhaps your book could help us with?
I think that there is there's a historical reason that the police have targeted African Americans, and the research does show that you're more likely to be stopped on the road if you're a black driver. And I think we know because of the origin of the way that police departments were formed, and because the police have the same prejudices that all of us have from the mainstream society. And the whole idea that African Americans driving nice cars are somehow suspect, they're somehow criminals. And there's so many examples of middle-class black Americans who are lawyers or physicians having their car stopped because the police assume that they must, if you're a black person driving a nice car, you must be a drug dealer or you must be somehow involved in some kind of criminal activity. I think one of the things that I wanted to do at the very end of the book was kind of ask some people, where do we go from here? We talk a lot about the young men, the young unarmed men who have been murdered by the police, Philando Castile, for example. And we don't really talk about what the solutions are. And I wanted to interview some people who had some really good ideas about what we can do about this. And one of them actually was a police officer from Canada, from Montreal, who basically said to me that we have to change the way we think about public service, about policing. That we think about it in the United States, our police think about it as law enforcement only. We don't think about it as community service. We think about it as law enforcement. And he was saying that in Montreal, they think about it as problem solving and community service and law enforcement. But there are multiple ways of looking at what it is that we that our police do to serve the public. And I thought that was very compelling. He also told me that the police officers in Montreal don't carry guns on the street. So when they're in bars or when they're off duty, their guns are in the police station. They're not carrying them when they're drinking. They're not carrying them when they're just out with their families. And I thought that was another very interesting difference. Yeah. Now, certainly Canada has had its share of racial problems, and they're not perfect. But I thought there were some interesting nuggets there.
Yeah.
But I also think we need a lot more training. One of the things that everyone told me is we spend a lot of time, police officers spend a lot of time at the range practicing shooting, but they don't spend the same amount of time practicing community relations, practicing how to diffuse angry situations, how to bring those situations down so that they don't escalate into a situation where there's a shooting. And I thought that was a very compelling statement that perhaps we do need to think more about how we spend time, you know, diffusing situations and working with people just as much time as being spent at the firing range.
Yeah, that's interesting. We've just got a couple minutes left, but I want to try to squeeze a couple more questions in. And the first one is I wanted to talk about the personal aspect of this book for you. I wanted to read a passage from the beginning of your book. It goes like this. Unexpectedly, I came to a much greater understanding of my parents and the courage and determination of everyone who, like them, grew up amid the humiliation, violence, and discrimination of the Jim Crow era. I was just curious about why was that understanding unexpected for you? Tell me the unexpected aspect of that.
I think both of my parents grew up, you know, not as wealthy people, but they ended up being incredibly successful. You know, my father was a chemical engineer. My mother was a principal of an elementary school, and they never, ever talked about the segregation that they faced in their childhood. So for me, I didn't grow up thinking about segregation at all and not really understanding it. There were things that, you know, that happened in our household, you know, that kind of brought it up, but my parents would never talk about it. But we spent summers in Fayetteville, North Carolina, which is my mother's home. And so I spent those summers in a racially segregated neighborhood where my aunt lived, but a racially segregated middle-class neighborhood. So the experiences of my youth made me think my parents were peculiar, you know, getting up at 2 o'clock in the morning to travel, you know, packing the car full of everything, never stopping at a restaurant or never stopping at a hotel on the way from Newark, New Jersey, where we lived, to Fayetteville, North Carolina. you know, carrying all the blankets and pillows in the car. So I thought that was a little peculiar, but I never really understood it. And I certainly never thought that it was that, you know, we were going on a dangerous journey when we got in the car. And the more I did the research, I really started to understand and appreciate what their sacrifice meant, what their growing up meant. And my mother did go to an HBCU. She went to, you know, Fayetteville State College, which was the only college that she could have attended in the 1940s when she went to college. She was the first one and the only one of her siblings to be able to get an education. And it was only because she was the baby in the family and her brother and her sister put her through college. You know, so starting to put all of these things together, I started to understand where my middle class background came from, and how much others had sacrificed so that I could have that, my brother and I could have that middle class growing up.
Well, it's a fascinating book, and it does a really wonderful job of weaving in different stories, including your own. That was Gretchen Soren, and again, her new book is titled Driving While Black: African-American Travel and the Road to Civil Rights. And again, it will be a PBS documentary airing sometime later this year. Professor Soren, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Oh, thank you so much, Grant.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, conversations in the public interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.